are going to finish tonight the last of the 8 visions, so the second half of them, the final 4, is what we're going to be walking through tonight by way of review. The first 4, the vision of horses represented the present peace that existed after the exile, which was not a good thing when you're looking for justice. And then there was intercession for cosmic justice. That was vision number 1. Vision 2, the horns and craftsmen, was a promise to destroy those who were evil and had oppressed Judah. Vision number 3, with the surveyor, was a promise of abundance for Jerusalem as it's being built, so much so that there didn't even need to be walls. God was going to be a wall of fire for them, and his presence would be with them, his glory would be in her midst. Then 4th one, the last one we looked at last week, was of the high priest. It was a provision of divine forgiveness, that God removed the sin from Joshua the high priest and removed evil from Judah. So the final 4 this evening, a vision of lampstand and trees, this flying scroll, woman in a basket, and 4 chariots. So let's go ahead and read through the first one, which is the longest of them. Let's read through chapter 4. It says, "Now the angel who talked with me came back and wakened me and a man who was wakened out of his sleep. And he said to me, 'What do you see?' So I said, 'I'm looking, and there's a lampstand of solid gold with a bowl on top of it, and on the stand, 7 lamps with 7 pipes to the 7 lamps. 2 olive trees are by it, one at the right of the bowl and the other at its left.' So I answered and spoke to the angel who talked with me, saying, 'What are these, my lord?' And the angel who talked with me answered and said, 'Do you not know what these are?' And I said, 'No, my lord.'" There's kind of an image of it. Go back to that. "So he answered and said to me, 'This is the word of the Lord to Zerubbabel, not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord of hosts. Who are you, O great mountain? Before Zerubbabel you shall become a plain, and he shall bring forth the capstone with shouts of grace, grace to it. Moreover, the word of the Lord came to me, saying, 'The hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundation of this temple, his hands shall also finish it. Then you will know that the Lord of hosts has sent me to you. For who has despised the day of small things? For even for these 7 rejoice to see the plumb line in the hand of Zerubbabel. They are the eyes of the Lord which scan to and fro throughout the whole earth.' Then I answered and said to him, 'What are these 2 olive trees at the right of the lampstand and at its left?' And I further answered and said to him, 'What are these 2 olive branches that drip into the receptacles of the 2 gold pipes from which the golden oil drains?' Then he answered me and said, 'Do you not know what these are?' And I said, 'No, my lord.' So he said, 'These are the 2 anointed ones who stand beside the Lord of the whole earth.'" Okay. So this is one of the most unique images that we've had painted for us so far. This is an image all described right here. A lampstand primarily. That's solid gold, and there's a bowl that's on top of the lampstand, and on the stand, 7 lamps with 7 pipes to the 7 lamps, an olive tree on either side of it, one at the right and one at the left of the bowl. So there's a variety of ways that this picture could be painted, primarily regarding the number of candlesticks on the lamp. The way that the Hebrew reads could mean that there are 7. It could mean that there are 7 plus 7, 14, or it could mean that there's 7 times 7, 49. And we don't really know, and the number of them is never super identified as a particular part of the vision or a meaning inside the vision. So this is an artist's rendering of what we're looking at here. There's the lampstand with 7 in this case. And you can see that the bowl connected to it, there's a bowl that's related to the lamp, and sounds as though there are pipes going from the bowl to the lamp sticks, which would be probably for the communication of oil to the lamp. And then later on in the vision, we find out that the 2 olive trees on either side are actually Maybe the closest idea we would have would be like a maple tree is tapped. Like they're actually pouring olive oil into the bowl through two pipes or so, or something like that. And that seems to be what's filling the lampstands. Okay, so that's about as close as we can get, or that's a good idea of what is happening here. The beginning of this vision was a little bit unique. The angel wakes Zechariah up, which could be simply his waking up from one vision and moving right into the next one, or it could be a uniquely delivered oracle. He is actually awoken out of his sleep to receive this oracle. And it is unique in the amount of the words from the Lord. There are two different sections that he receives from the Lord, verses 6 and 7, and then verses 9 and 10. So as an overview, what this vision is pursuing, what it's teaching, is that it's encouraging those leaders, Zerubbabel, Joshua, even Zechariah, by announcing that Zerubbabel is going to complete the temple. That's the point of the vision. Zerubbabel is going to complete the temple. Now keep in mind, that's very applicable historically because they've just begun by the encouragement of Haggai to pursue the building of the temple, and this is within the first few months of their building, and likely they're facing these discouragements, and as we'll see later on here, they're probably even facing they're not enamored with the product. It's really not that great of a temple, particularly if you can recall what the old temple looked like. And so just discouraged and frustrated, like maybe they don't have the resources they need, or they don't have the manpower that they need, or whatever it might be. I mean, the last temple was built in the most grand era of Israel's history, and no expense was spared in its building. So you can imagine this feels like a budget version, a DIY version. Like it's just not awesome. So how does this communicate that? And as tends to happen, Zechariah looks at this vision, and the angel says, "What do you see?" He describes it, but then he ends the description by saying, "What are these, my Lord? I don't know what I'm looking at." Obviously, the angel doesn't answer with, "Well, this is a lampstand, and this is trees." He's like, "No, I know that. I saw that. What does it mean?" And so the angel begins a description. He answers and says to me, "This is the word of the Lord to Zerubbabel, not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord of hosts." Pretty short, sweet. We're going to save that one for the end. Verse 7, "Who are you, O great mountain? Before Zerubbabel, you shall become a plain, and he shall bring forth the capstone with shouts of grace, grace to it." Okay, there's even more. Let's go to the next one because there's even more clarity here. "Moreover, the word of the Lord came to me saying, the hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundation of this temple. His hands also shall finish it. Then you will know that the Lord of hosts has sent me to you." Okay, so there is a very clear statement that Zerubbabel is who's in view here, contra Joshua, the high priest in the last vision. So now we have the leader in view. He says he's begun. He laid the foundation to the temple, and it's going to be him that finishes the temple. Okay, so that's a word of encouragement because that's the present leader. That means it's not going to be too long before they finish. And then they will know, once this temple is completed, under the rule, the guidance of Zerubbabel, that this message of Zechariah was truly from the Lord. Okay, so now let's go backward. If that's what he's getting at, if he says the hands of Zechariah, or Zerubbabel, who've laid the foundation stone, the first ones, the principal stones, it's also going to be him that brings forth the capstone. Okay, so the first and the last stones of what? The temple, that which they're building, which is at least alluded to, if not represented by, the lampsticks. So a lampstick was one of the articles that went into the tabernacle as commanded by God. And it was monitored by the priests. It went also into the temple. It was a ornate and a lavish piece. The descriptions of it are found in Exodus and then in 1 Kings. It was incredible, kind of the amount of detail that went into it. And it was all gold. It was one piece of gold. So it represents probably both the tabernacle and the temple. It's an icon of that place. And once these candles were lit, they were never supposed to go out. That was one of the responsibilities of the priest, would be to keep the candles going, because that was a testament, as it's described in the not the end, but in Exodus 27, that this was their responsibility, and it was a testament to the people, probably of the Lord's presence, as a representation of His presence. He was the light in the tabernacle. Well, that's not, I don't believe, explicitly stated anywhere. So you have the image of the lamp, and one of the things that's happening is it's sourced with oil. It's not being, like, the vision itself takes care of the priestly responsibilities, because out of the olive trees is flowing the oil into the bowl, which has tubes to go, these channels to go to the lamp. Okay? So in 7, he's saying, this mountain, who are you, O great mountain? Before Zerubbabel you shall become plain. He's saying that nothing will get in the way. Nothing will stop the building. The mountain could be enemies, opponents, which occurred. The mountain could be discouragement and the people giving up. The mountain could be the lack of resources. And he's saying, before Zerubbabel, every mountain is going to be leveled. It's like nothing will get in the way of us finishing this. Before Zerubbabel, you shall become a plain. There's a verse in Isaiah 40 that sounds very similar to this. You know, every valley will be raised, every mountain and hill will be made low, the rough ground will become level, and the rugged places will become plain. Like, it's smooth. And so it's a statement of certainty. And now in reverse order, 6, we have the singular phrase, not by might nor by power, but by my spirit. That's probably one of the better known verses in the Old Testament. This is very often quoted. And what he's saying here is the means by which the temple will be accomplished, the means by which it will be built. It will not be accomplished because Israel's just that great. It won't be accomplished because they just have that many resources, because now they have freedom from their oppressors. It's not because of any of that. He's saying that he is going to accomplish it because it's in his good purpose to accomplish it. So it's a good reminder to them of the object of their trust, that they should rest in the word of the Lord and his ability to accomplish it by his spirit rather than anything that, like, any even visible evidence toward the same promise. Okay, so the means is first. He's going to accomplish it by his spirit. Nothing is going to stop it. It's certain. Certainty restated in verses 8 and 9, that it's the very hands, the foundation, and then the capstone are both placed by Zerubbabel, giving credence to Zechariah as a prophet of the Lord. And then a little word of encouragement at the end, 10 and 11. For who has despised the day of small things? And I believe this is a reference to the temple as it is in their rebuilding. To that statement of, it's not that great. It is a small thing. There's only a few rocks on top of each other. And they know that even when it's finished, it won't come close to having the splendor of Solomon's temple from a physical perspective. He says, but don't despise that. Like, don't grow weary. Don't be, as he said in Haggai, you know, what the few of you that are left that knew what the first one looked like, you'll know that this won't match its glory. Don't despise the day of small things. For these 7, which is the candles, These seven rejoiced to see the plumb line in the hand of Zerubbabel. They, the seven, are the eyes of the Lord, which scan to and fro throughout the whole earth. So this is a simple statement that God is taking pleasure in the rebuilding of the temple. As his eyes scan this earth, and he sees that Zerubbabel holds the plumb line to the temple, and it's being rebuilt. He takes great pleasure in that, and they ought to as well. They shouldn't despise what's happening, because it is progress toward the fulfillment of God's promises. So then he asks, okay, that explains a little bit the lampstand, but what about the trees? What do the trees represent? Why are these two at the right and at the left? And I further answered and asked him, what are these two olive branches that drip into the receptacles of the two gold pipes from which the oil drains? And he answered, you don't know what they are. And I said, no, my Lord. And he said, these are the two anointed ones who stand beside the Lord of the whole earth. So this is the fullness of the answer, which is not super full. And this phrase, these are the two anointed ones, is these are the two sons of oil. That's the Hebrew. So sons of oil is translated anointed ones. So there are two sons of oil. Do we know who that is? Well, based on both Haggai and Zechariah put together, seems pretty clear that these two would be referencing those two leaders, those two that have been chosen to lead the people. So probably Zerubbabel and Joshua as representatives or current, even placeholders, those who have been set in the priestly and kingly responsibilities. So we have on both sides the priest and the king, though he's not, I mean, he's the governor, but the regent. So what's happening, Joshua and Zerubbabel, priest and Davidic prince, who together are the means of bringing new hope to the community. Here's a quote from a commentator. It says, through the high priest, acquittal is pronounced and access to God's presence made possible. Through the prince, the temple is completed. So that's exactly what Zerubbabel is doing. And the lampstand allowed to shine out to the world. Two messiahs, little m messiahs, or anointed ones, sons of oil, have their rules coordinated. Neither is adequate without the other, but the two functions were to be brought together in the person and the work of Christ. So that which really sources the light, that which is providing oil for the light to go forth, are these responsibilities. This priest and this king, temporarily held, historically held by these two men, ultimately and fully brought together in the person of Jesus Christ. So that's vision number five, which is that there is power available through God's Spirit, that the Lord's provision safeguards Israel's future. He is going to see it accomplished. His provision safeguards Israel's future. Okay, so vision number six. Then I turned and raised my eyes and saw there a flying scroll. And he said to me, what do you see? So I answered, I see a flying scroll. Its length is 20 cubits and its width 10 cubits. Then he said to me, this is the curse that goes out over the face of the whole earth. Every thief shall be expelled according to this side of the scroll. Every perjurer shall be expelled according to that side of it. I will send out the curse, says the Lord of hosts. It shall enter the house of the thief and the house of the one who swears falsely by my name. It shall remain in the midst of his house and consume it with its timber and its stones. Okay, so there's a scroll flying through the sky. And if our cubit measurement is close to accurate, as 18 inches, then this would be a 30-foot by 15-foot scroll, right? So a supersized scroll flying through the sky. And there's words on both sides of it, a curse on either side of it. On one side, there's the curse, every thief shall be expelled. And on the other side, there's a curse, every perjurer shall be expelled. What is it doing? It flies into the house of thieves and perjurers, and it marks and remains and destroys the home until the home is completely consumed. The point of this vision is to demonstrate the need for spiritual repentance. That even though he's made these promises to his people, there's sin in the land. And this scroll is coming into the land to identify and reveal the fact that there is sin everywhere. After great promise in the last one, there's now this kind of veiled threat of judgment. You must be made clean, or you must repent. You must believe. You can't be thieves and liars if you're to inherit this kingdom. So a 13 by 15 foot scroll, kind of like a billboard, I suppose, for us. The scroll evokes the fact that this is a message from God, right? It's the word of God that has come. It's the written word, revelation. Size communicates its clarity, its simplicity. Like, there's not a lot written on it. And its importance, it's in large letters for everyone to see. It's not like an undercover message to one person or another. It flies through the land so that everyone's reminded. The two sins that are identified, the thief and the perjurer, so the one who steals and the one who swears falsely, perjury meaning lying under oath. And what that's not intended to do is to make us think, wow, what stealers and liars. But that each side of the scroll represents probably one of the tablets. And from the first half, we have don't bear false witness. And from the second half, we have don't steal. And so what's represented is that the law, the Ten Commandments, the Decalogue, is flying through the land, reminding people and exposing people of the fact that they are sinners. So there's still a problem that they must obey. Like, they need to follow the commands of God in order for his divine blessing to be on them. So the law of Moses is on a billboard everywhere. And it functions almost like the angel of the Lord functioned in Exodus, doesn't it? It like identifies the homes that need addressed, and it enters the home and destroys and then leaves. And it won't leave until judgment has been accomplished. So until all of the house is completely consumed with its timber and with its stones. So it's no longer the firstborn, right? This is the angel of final death for the whole home because it's sinful. So the curse on lawbreakers is what this vision is about, that the Lord judges Israel for breaking his covenant, which is all of them. Vision number 7. Then the angel who talked with me came out and said to me, "Lift up your eyes and see what is this that goes forth." So I asked, "What is it?" And he said, "It is a basket that is going forth." So I said, "This is their resemblance or their eyes throughout the earth. Here is a lead disc lifted up. And this is a woman sitting inside the basket." Then he said, "This is wickedness." And he thrust her down into the basket and threw the lead cover over its mouth. Then I raised my eyes and looked, and there were two women coming with the wind in their wings, for they had wings like the wings of a stork, and they lifted up the basket between earth and heaven. So I said to the angel who talked with me, "Where are they carrying the basket?" And he said to me, "To build a house for it in the land of Shinar. When it is ready, the basket will be set there on its base." Okay, another bit unusual one. There's a basket with a lead lid, and inside it is a woman whose name is Wickedness. She represents sin. Two winged women pick up the basket, fly to the land of Shinar, and there they build a house for it, and then put it in the house. Okay? So the word that's used for basket is ephah, which is a measuring basket. It would be anywhere between 5 to 10 gallons. So once again, that means we have a supersized object. We have, because this woman, Wickedness, is not going to fit in a 5-gallon bucket, right? So it's a large basket with a lead lid. The purpose of the lead lid is never identified. The only common suggestion is that it's heavy so that she can't get out, and so that it's firmly established, like it's a trap that can't be sprung. The woman, so there's two times it's stated. It says, one, this is their resemblance. This is the word is their eyes. This is, I think, what they look like in the earth. This is what the people of Israel look like. They look like wickedness. So again, the problem is sin that's identified. Now, why is it a woman? And I think there's two good answers to that. Two good answers would be that the book of Proverbs illuminates this a little bit, that it's poetic as representative of that which might be desired by someone, that which might be practiced, a life that there is to live, a woman wisdom and a woman folly. So parallel to woman folly would be woman wickedness. It is her, that which is opposed to the path of God, that which is sinful, this worldly practice, rejection of the law, rejection of the inherited way of wisdom, that needs removed from the land. There needs to no longer be the option, Lady Folly. And the other parallel, they're not unrelated, the parallel reason would be that in some of the prophets, the idea of the sin as a prostitute is often imaged. It's like this is, we could be saying, even with all the cultic practices and the often sexualized cultic practices, that all of that is being placed away. All of this false worship, all of the temple prostitution and things like that. But I think those two ideas maybe together favoring, maybe leaning on the first a little bit more. So this is wickedness. And she gets shoved into the basket and carried away to Shinar. This is the ancient name for Babylon. In Genesis 10:10, which is the Table of Nations, it's identified as the ancient name for Babylon. It evokes Babel imagery as well, the Tower of Babel, which is in the land of Shinar. That's where that took place. And so what's happening is these women have taken sin out of the camp, and they've taken it back to a place where it belongs, to Babel, the representative nation that is the origin of evil. Like it represents all of evil, all that which opposes God. And there's going to be a prison that's built there, a holding place that is going to last. and all of the sin is going to be placed in the holding place forever. Okay? So it's the removal of evil from the land. It's the purifying of God's people is what this vision represents. Unless we think that God is just sending it away with these two women to just forget about it, that kind of imagery, particularly in poetry, is a way of addressing the removal of the sin, which is even representative of the forgiveness of the sin. Things in the Psalms like that he would remove it as far as the east is from the west, that you can take it away, or some of the Old Testament imagery of that there is spatial, that there is purity in space from wickedness. Like the way that the city stays clean from a leper is if they go out there. Not that they ignore the leper, like they ignore the presence of a leper or that they cease to exist. But the problem is addressed in the removal of the plague. Or like the Day of Atonement, that you send the sin outside of the camp. And in so doing, it's addressed, poetically speaking. So the removal. So this is not just God brushing it under the rug, like, well, let's tuck all the sin over here in Shinar. It's a poetic way of saying he's dealt with it. Which takes us to the eighth and final vision. Then I turned and raised my eyes and looked, and behold, four chariots were coming from between two mountains, and the mountains were mountains of bronze. With the first chariot were red horses, with the second chariot black horses, with the third chariot white horses, and with the fourth chariot dappled horses, strong steeds. Then I answered and said to the angel who talked with me, "What are these, my lord?" And the angel answered and said to me, "These are four spirits of heaven who go out from their station before the Lord of all the earth. The one with the black horses is going to the north country. The white are going after them, and the dappled are going toward the south country. Then the strong steeds went out, eager to go, that they might walk to and fro throughout the earth. And he said, 'Go, walk to and fro throughout the earth.' So they walked to and fro throughout the earth. And he called to me and spoke to me, saying, 'See, those who go toward the north country have given rest to my spirit in the north country.'" Okay, so this picture is not actually, just for the sake of pairing them next to each other, I want to read the first vision again, so that, because there are a lot of similarities. Often even argue that this is an inclusio, because you have, well, let's just remind ourselves of the first vision. Chapter 1, verse 8. "I saw by night, and behold, a man riding on a red horse, and it stood among the myrtle trees in the hollow, behind whom were horses red, sorrel, and white. Then I said, 'My lord, what are these?' So the angel who talked with me said to me, 'I will show you what they are.' And the man who stood among the myrtle trees answered and said, 'These are the ones whom the Lord has sent to walk to and fro throughout the earth.' So they answered the angel of the Lord who stood among the myrtle trees and said, 'We have walked to and fro throughout the earth, and behold, all the earth is resting quietly.'" So the argument made in that first one is the vision is like an angelic group that is sent out to survey, that is sent out to be like the spies, to do reconnaissance, to see. And they return to the Lord with information, right? With a message. And so here, we still have the same colored horses and the fact that they are military horses. There are a few distinctions that we'll notice as we walk through. So first, we have chariots instead of just riders. A chariot with a pair of red, a pair with black, a pair with white, and a pair with dappled. And we still don't fully know, or we can't say with confidence, there's a couple options, what the dappled horses, their color actually is. And their purpose, well, let's see, actually, let's look at this first. So the mountains, between two mountains. That's a little bit different too, because in the first vision, they were in a grove of some sort. And here they ride from and between two of the mountains. So what are these mountains and what do they represent? Psalm 68:17 gives us one pretty good option. Psalm 68, verse 17 reads, okay, so a mountain of God is the mountain of Bashan, a mountain of many peaks is the mountain of Bashan. Why do you fume with envy, you mountains of many peaks? This is the mountain which God desires to dwell in. Yes, the Lord will dwell in it forever. The chariots of God are 20,000, even thousands of thousands. The Lord is among them as in Sinai in the holy place, or he comes from them as in Sinai in the holy place. You've ascended on high, you've led captivity captive, you've received gifts from among men, even from the rebellious, that the Lord might dwell there. So one and really good option here is that the Lord, as a military commander with a host of chariots, as opposed to scouts, he's now bringing out his force because they're riding, and he rides from his home. He rides from the mountain in order to head out on not just an expedition, but on a conquest. So thus, here's another quotation, thus the Lord's military might depicts the more profound theological message that God reigns with sovereignty over his entire creation. No empire or geographic expanse can hinder the Lord's rule. Moreover, the four chariots further emphasize the Lord's total dominion over the four corners of the earth. So absolute sovereignty. If we were to put specific mountains to this, which we may be able to or not, it might be Mount Zion, the Mount of Olives, if we're looking to the eschaton, and between these is the Kidron Valley. So it could be a future promise of his actual ride between physical mountains. Could also be from heaven, that he rides from his throne today, and he rides down to earth to claim Zion. The fact that these mountains are bronze, again, these things aren't clearly identified, so we have to be, we hold all of what, both the mountain and the bronze a little bit loosely, because the angel doesn't explain what they are. But the bronze often is representative of that which is strong and holy, that which is powerful and pure, which is the place from which God rides. So his throne is those things. In the angel's description of who these riders are, or the chariots, yeah, not the riders technically, the chariots as pulled by horses, that these are the four spirits of heaven. And our two options for translation are either wind or spirits. Wind is attractive if we believe that he's talking about or trying to emphasize the expanse, right? The four corners, you might say, the four winds of the earth, as it would be a very common way. Even in Jeremiah 49, he says that explicitly, the four winds, namely the four corners of the earth. But spirits emphasize, and it's probably to be preferred, spirits emphasizes the personal nature of these four messengers or ambassadors or these four representative military persons. And there's a possibility, well, maybe we'll say that in a moment. Revelation 6 brings up these four horsemen that are the same colors as these four. It's possible that Zechariah and John are viewing the same thing. And if so, well, the Revelation description is far more vivid than the Zechariah description. But we would have to be cautious with that one-to-one parallel because the text doesn't make the one-to-one parallel. We just say, look, there's some commonalities. It may be talking about the same thing. If that is the case, well, in Revelation 6, let's turn there for a moment. He gives us a lot more information. So for the sake of, I think, the closeness, or if nothing else, the idea of the connection, let's read through the first eight verses here in Revelation 6. So now these are four of the seals. Now I saw when the Lamb opened one of the seals, and I heard one of the four living creatures saying with a voice like thunder, come and see. And I looked, and behold, a white horse. He who sat on it had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he went out conquering and to conquer. So the white horse represents the victorious conqueror. The second one, when he opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature saying, "Come and see." Another horse, fiery red, went out. And it was granted to the one who sat on it to take peace from the earth, and that people should kill one another. And there was given to him a great sword. So the red color representing war. When he opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, "Come and see." So I looked, and behold, a black horse. And he who sat on it had a pair of scales in his hand. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four living creatures saying, "A quart of wheat for a denarius, and three quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not harm the oil and the wine." Black horse representing scarcity or famine, lack, which leads to destruction. Then when he opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature saying, "Come and see." So I looked, and behold, a pale horse. And the name of him who sat on it was Death, and Hades followed with him. And power was given to them over a fourth of the earth to kill with sword, with hunger, with death, and by the beasts of the earth. So the white horse representing death. So that's a possibility, to be sure. And if nothing else, it does help in the apocalyptic literature to sort of paint like what generally God's riders go to accomplish. When he sends them forth, it is violent, it is messy, and it is final. This is the last chapter leading to the endless summer of eternity. So these are the four representatives, spirits, angels of heaven, who go out from their station before the Lord of all the earth. The one with the black horses, he goes north. Now, what does north represent in Zechariah and in the prophets? North represents Babylon. So he rides against the premier enemy of God, the final, you might say, the final enemy of God. And the white ones follow. If the Revelation color coordination should be put here, then you would have famine, destruction, followed by victory. Okay, so he's, whether the color coding is something we ought to do or not, the intention is the same. He sends a double portion up to Babylon to handle the great threat of evil. And then the dappled are going toward the south country. So the other enemy, Egypt, he goes south to destroy there. None to the east, none to the west. And whatever happened to the red ones? We don't know. He doesn't say. The red ones aren't sent out. So either you say we don't know, which I think is what we will do, or the only recommendation I saw is that the red ones stay. They stay in Judah. And again, if Revelation, then they stay for blood. For bloodshed. They stay for war, perhaps even signaling like an Armageddon image or the final war that takes place close to, in Judah, in Israel. So why he doesn't go north, south, east, west isn't totally clear. Why the red ones aren't sent out isn't totally clear. But that they aren't seems to be. And that he addresses from Israel's geography the greatest threats with two to the strongest and one to the next strongest. On your east, you've got desert and barrenness. And on the west, you have the Mediterranean Sea. So that's not where their greatest threats are coming from, militaristically. And then these strong steeds, just notice the emphasis on being sent out. You can just, they're sitting here from their station before the Lord of all the earth. They've been waiting here for a long time. They have a post that they man before God. And he finally sends them. And so they go out, and they're eager to go that they might walk to and fro throughout the earth. There's a phrase that comes up three times in this verse. And he said, go, walk to and fro throughout the earth. So they walked to and fro throughout the earth. It's just this ultimate, final, these really strong creatures, these messengers of God, his army that's been chomping at the bit to ride against his enemies. He finally looses them, and they fly from between these two bronze mountains, and they bring this complete destruction to the enemies of God. So this is in contrast to the first one. It wasn't, look, there's peace, and that's a bad thing. And then the intercession. Lord, would you please bring justice? Now they fly from his throne, and they fly for war and blood and victory. And the conclusion, God's own conclusion, is that he calls to Zechariah. And he says, see, those who go to the north country, right, those who go to fight and destroy Babylon, they've given rest to my spirit in the north country. So both of the visions of the horses end with peace. The first one, poor peace. First one, temporary, agitated peace, frustrating peace. The second one, following this great ride of God's army, even rest for God himself. It's like the seventh day, where because of this full and complete transformation of the globe, the complete sending out and riddance of evil, that those who remained in their sin have been cursed and destroyed. All of this together communicates that it's over. And then God rests. And so the visions are brought to conclusion with a similar but fuller, a next phase of the horseman vision. So, all eight together, present peace and intercession for cosmic justice, a promise to destroy the evildoers, a promise of abundance, a protection, a wall of fire, and his presence, his glory in their midst, a provision of divine forgiveness and the removal of evil, that there is the Lord's provision safeguards Israel's future, that the Lord is going to judge Israel for breaking the covenant, that he will completely remove evil from their midst, and that finally he will bring fullness of peace for all his people and for himself. That is the eight visions of Zechariah altogether. So before we close, any thoughts, questions, if you want to jump in on anything as far as the visions are concerned, before we close that chapter of Zechariah?
I have a question as far as the biblical timeline. So I know that Zerubbabel was, I think it was brought up in the book of Ezra.
Mm-hmm.
So, which is like kind of toward the middle of the Old Testament. So
yeah.
Were they in the same timeline, I'm assuming, or was Zerubbabel taking forever to build the temple?
No, you're right. It is the same Zerubbabel, and that simply concerns the organization of the Old Testament. So Ezra's finishing up the historical books. So you have really from, well, at least Genesis, Exodus, through Joshua, Judges, Ruth, and they continue through the histories, 1st and 2nd Kings, and you end with Ezra to kind of wrap up the histories. And then, after the wisdom section, then you have the prophets, and then they move chronologically. So you really are kind of moving with both consecutively, and it is confusing. It's not as easy to do that, but yeah, that's why. So it is the same Zerubbabel, and if I recall correctly, it takes about 20 years, so from when Haggai prophesied, I think it's about 20 years later, and they finished the temple.
There's, you mentioned the parallel in Revelation with these horses, and that's very suggestive. I don't think we ought to dismiss that at all.
Right.
But also, it seems that the woman that was taken to Babylon was sealed with the lead seal in the basket. She's not destroyed. She's set on a base or a pedestal. And I realize that she's removed from Israel, from the nation. But could that not be parallel to the woman in Revelation 17? And she returns and opens up. And then is destroyed also. But
I was thinking of Jezebel too, because the Lord is angry with one of the churches. They're following the teachings of Jezebel. And then you have Jezebel, obviously, in Kings. But
there's not the connection.
She's kind of symbolic of the prostitute. Mm-hmm.
So let's just read the first few verses, first six verses of 17. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and talked with me, saying, "Come, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication." So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads, 10 horns. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication. And on her forehead a name was written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. So there's a few things running through my mind. One of them is that this woman is representative of all of Babylon, right? And how even the kings of the earth have spent time with this woman. And in Zechariah, it appears to be, and I think the point is, the purging of the sins of Israel and Judah, that those sins are removed. So if, I don't know if you could say, and this is just a bit of a shot in the dark, but like that this woman is a representative of Israel's fornication, of Israel's participation with Babylon. But that is that woman that's removed is not if that's representative of the sins being forgiven, then that would be different, I think, than the point of Revelation 17, which is not that the sins of all who committed fornication with the woman are removed or gone. And the other little part that I wonder about is the place to which they go, that, you know, 17 says out to basically to the desert, and the woman you find is Babylon. And in Zechariah, it's wickedness being put away, a home built in Babylon. So I don't know, there's certainly similarities, and maybe different portrayals of similar ideas, to be sure. But I don't know if initially I'm like, yep, same woman. I don't know. Bears certainly more study. That's the connection. We've hardly touched the connections between Zechariah and Revelation, and they are enormous. A lot, even far more than just the horses and the woman. Like in chapter 11 would be another place that you go, and the building of the temple, and even a measuring stick being given to John, perhaps as representative of Zerubbabel. And, you know, they're building this temple of God, and there's two olive trees and a lampstand before the God of the earth. And Then there's two witnesses. And so it's like there's so, so much that we're really not even scratching the surface of. Yeah, there could be something to that. That was part of the observation I was making between the two women, in that Israel's receiving a word from the Lord in post-exile, and it functions differently than Revelation functions, because maybe not micro fulfillments, but fulfillments of these prophecies took place historically, and they anticipated truer and greater fulfillment. Whereas in Revelation, that's like the last word that we received. And it pretty much all points forward to this grand, exclusive future culmination. And that is international. So perhaps there's, something to that. Do you have a thought? Is the oil symbolic of the Spirit? Back in the in vision seven, no, in vision five. Yeah. He doesn't say that, right? Like Zechariah doesn't say it, or the angel doesn't explain it. So I'd be cautious. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. It's interesting to read. So commentaries are interesting on these, and it really does depend on who you're reading. So, like, if for example, this isn't where you were going, but if for example, like you read MacArthur on Zechariah, somebody like that, it's going to be really dogmatic and use a lot, he's going to go right to, absolutely, Revelation 6, here it is, we know the colors, we know, like, all that's going to be quite plain and simple to him. Or often, more overview, like an overview commentary, they'll just, like, drop that, like, drop an idea or drop a connection. You really don't have the time or the breadth to, mine it out, give arguments for it, give arguments against it, where the historical interpretation's been, all that sort of stuff. So just as a foundational interpretive principle, much like a parable, we have to be really careful in applying more than the revelation explanation that's given. Just like in the parables, all the images that Jesus gives. If when they say, what did that mean? He leaves out one or two of the pictures that were a part of the parable. You have to be really careful to supply what those mean, because it wasn't said. So I think that's true here too. When, like, the most pertinent points of the explanation are going to be mentioned by the angel. And if he doesn't, then already we're on thin ice, but we could talk ideas, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Also, I was thinking, your seven lampstands, the seven eyes of the Lord. What is the number seven, the seventh day of the Lord rest? Sure. Yeah, very, very commonly, and I think it would be true in this vision that seven is the number of maturity or completion, that's fullness. So if the seven eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth, he's communicating, he has complete vision, like whatever the omni of sight is, his omnisight, which informs his omniscience. So, yeah, So, as a general rule, not every time it's used by any means, but as a general rule and in prophecies, seven is communicating fullness. So, yep, I'm on board with that. Okay, well, let's pray.